Hello there, my name is Sheila Grace Harvey and welcome to Relationship Revelations. And today I'm very pleased to have a guest with me, Paul Kay, and I'll just give you a little bit of background on him. He's been a dedicated student of spiritual thought and practices since his youth in England. His explorations have taken him into yoga, Zen, and the spiritual foundations of movement and the martial arts. His interests include the philosophies of such poets and teachers as Lao Tzu, Rumi, Kabir, and the esoteric teachings of Jesus Christ. He's designed workshops on the practical application of spiritual principles and presented them worldwide. His presentations are inspiring, practical, and filled with a wonderful sense of humor and wisdom. For over the last 35 years, he studied with renowned educator and author John Roger, and is the president of the Church of the Movement of Spiritual Inner Awareness, MSIA, which is a non-denominational church that teaches soul transcendence. He's an ordained minister and has a doctorate in spiritual science. And most importantly for today, he's co-authored three books with John Roger, Momentum, Letting Love Lead, What's It Like Being You, and the book we're going to be talking about today, which is The Rest of Your Life. And on a personal note, I've known Paul for a long time. He's one of the funniest people I know and can certainly make spiritual things very easy to understand and uplifting. So welcome, Paul.
Oh, lovely to be with you. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you're welcome. Well, Paul, I have to say, you're British. You had a Jewish upbringing. You went to a Church of England school. You became an accountant. And you ended up as president of the Movement of Spiritual Inner Awareness in Los Angeles. That's quite a journey from one to the other. I'd like to know a little bit about how you got from being in England to meeting John Roger and working in LA.
Well, I also like to add to that kind of eclectic mix the fact that I have an Asian heart. I have a very, very much affinity for China and for Japan. And that's kind of where my heart kind of leans towards. So, yes, just putting it all together there was quite a mix. And I remember at being 14 years of age, and being in, I think it's Foyle's bookstore in Charing Cross Road.
Yes.
And going into the spiritual section and just spending hours there. And when I think back to 14 years old, I thought, goodness, I must have really, that's young. And so, but at the time, it just seemed that I had to find out what life was about. And that took me on a good 7-year search, I would say, of looking for a guru, looking for a master, looking for answers, and, you know, the things that actually a lot of people go through, but it happened to me at a very young age. And I came across John Roger at the age of 21 or so. And was quite resistant to the idea. My friend was involved with the group and who I was a fellow accountant with. And, you know, he spoke about it. And I resisted it for the simple reason that John Roger was from the United States. He was American. And I was tending to look for someone a little bit more exotic, someone Indian perhaps or something like that. So it took me a while to get my head around it, but the awakening that took place within me was a very gradual, and I would say a gradual opening of the heart, which kind of took place over about a year and a half, and then one day I just found myself really very accepting of the teachings, and then I embraced them, and now I attempt to live them.
Right. Well, the book, The Rest of Your Life, I mean, I think that it's extremely timely when you consider how people are living their lives these days. I mean, most people don't seem to be getting enough sleep. They're not getting the time out. They're not resting. You know, I remember when weekends were time out when you relax, but these days a lot of people schedule in things all through the weekend. So even that doesn't mean that people are getting the rest that they need. And the other thing is, you know, holidays every year. I mean, I remember as a child growing up, you know, we'd go for 2 weeks every year to a farm in Wales and to the beach. And, you know, with a lot of our parents, I think, at those times were all working in specific jobs and they had so many weeks holiday a year. It was a lot easier to schedule those things. But people today are self-employed. They work on hourly rates. A lot of people feel they can't even afford to take time out. So really what you're talking about in this book is about how can you get the rest that you need, but it isn't about putting it off to something down the track. It's how can we do it each day in our day-to-day lives. Could you talk to us a little bit about that?
Well, I think what I tend to be a somewhat of a classic baby boomer. I was born in 1950, and it puts me right square in the middle of that. And like most baby boomers, I'm finding myself at a point in my life where actually I'm quite happy, quite fulfilled. I'm happily married. I've achieved what I've wanted to, beyond what I've wanted to achieve. And the one area where I notice is that I really don't have the financial resources to be able to just say, okay, I'm not going to work anymore. And when I examine my financial resources, the reality is, and the reality was when I looked at it, is that I probably am going to be working for the rest of my life. And all being well, of course, you know, there's certain factors that need to be there, such as good health mainly. But all things being equal, I'll be working for the rest of my life. And then as I looked at working for the rest of my life, I really had to say, I really, if I'm going to be working long term, and I'm talking about into my 70s and possibly into my 80s, I'm going to have to be living life somewhat differently from the adrenaline-driven life that many people lead, because that leads to burnout and lots of health problems down the road. And so that's when I realized, wait a minute, I don't take 2 weeks for vacation. I don't take off time. I'm not lying on the beach. I'm not recuperating. And so what was the answer? And the answer came to me very clearly that I had to rest as I went along. And that's been a pursuit and a practice, and it's been quite a fascinating thing. And I've done lots of research into the matter, and I have lots to say about it.
Good. Well, we want to hear a bit more about it. So what have you done in incorporating into your life that assists you to have rest as you go?
Well, one of the things that is really quite vital is to slow down. That's a very interesting approach, because immediately people say, I don't have time to slow down. And it's not like you slow down all the time. It's just that you slow down when you don't need to be at a super pace. We all need to rush somewhere. I mean, that's a reality of life. We can talk about not rushing, but sometimes, you know, just we need to get somewhere fast, or something is put on us that was unexpected. But that doesn't happen 100% of the time. So what's important is that we find the moments when there isn't a rush, and not to be continuing the hyperspeed while that's going on. So it's a question of slowing down, and in the slowing down, to take in what's around us. I'm a great advocate of finding the sacred in the ordinary. So the simple act of washing one's hands, cleaning one's teeth even, can be almost a meditative process rather than a frenetic one. If you watch most people brush their teeth or floss, it's quite a frenetic, tense thing that they're doing. And it's interesting, your listeners, possibly when they go to bed tonight, was just to observe the way they go about that, when in fact it could be a very, almost like a massage for the mouth, done in a very relaxed, slow way, and without tension. So that's one big key for me, slowing down, pausing, just taking a moment in the midst of anything, just to pause for 1 or 2 seconds. You know, it's very interesting that the heart, it beats for 11 hours a day, and it rests for 13 hours a day. So even within our body systems know when to rest, and the heart is beating continuously, so to speak, for our whole lives, and for people who are living, let's say, 100 years or so, I mean, that's quite an achievement to be continually beating. But we find out it's not really continuous. It's beating 11 hours and resting 13. So it's a very good metaphor for the way that we can live our lives.
Yeah. You reminded me of just yesterday. I was busy doing something, and I have a cat from next door that I'm always talking about. She's a really gorgeous cat, and she started crying because she really wanted to be hugged, and I was kind of busy doing, and then I stopped, and I thought, you know what? this is a lovely moment. She came and sat on my lap, and we had like this gorgeous little hug, and I call her my little love bug because she is such a loving little darling. And it was the most precious moment, and I could have missed that. And I'm thinking that in life it's so easy to miss some beautiful moments just because we feel we don't have time. But the reality is we mostly do have that time.
And we can just incorporate these practices into our daily life. Someone wanted to take my photograph the other day. I was with someone, and we had just finished a counseling session. She said, may I take your photograph? And I said, of course. And she took out her camera with a fair degree of tension. And then when she put back her camera, she was still tensing up, and I couldn't stand it anymore. I said, look, slow down. Follow your breath, I told her, because we had talked about it in the counseling session. And here it was a practical application. Follow your breath. You're ahead of your breath. You're rushing. You're tense. Follow your breath. And it was just a wow moment for her. And she realized that it was going to be quite a challenge for her to incorporate that in her life. And what was she doing? As soon as she slowed down, she then moved the zipper, which is what she was trying to do, in a much more slow, conscious, mindful way. And her whole body relaxed in that process. So even in the most simple of acts, we can find ourselves resting within that process.
Yes. You reminded me in what you were just saying a little earlier in terms of we can't do everything at this kind of a high pace all the time. And, you know, when something like someone like an athlete is running, for instance, a marathon, they know that they have these times of real exertion. But they also need time to rest and recuperate. And that's something that we seem to have lost along the way, that we sometimes just need that little break in between. We can't keep at that pace all the time. And one of the things that you talk about in the book, which are absolutely one of my favorite things, is you talk about the nap.
Now, well, I had one today.
Yes, I had one today?
I had a nap today, yes.
Now, I used to call them kips. Is that a British thing?
I think
kip?
So.
It is. You know, sometimes I've lived in a few countries and I forget where something comes from, but I used to love my afternoon kips. I think they're a wonderful thing, an afternoon nap. And when you think about some of the Mediterranean countries who've been doing this, you know, for years, where they sleep obviously in the heat of the day when it's not very practical to be pushing against, you know, what is going on. But yet we don't often seem to do that. We don't seem to have the common sense at times to go with what's really happening in our lives, and we tend to push. And a nap is just one little way that we can take a little bit of time out and refresh. Do you have anything else to say about naps?
Well, just that really they are absolutely tremendous. And if, you know, many things that I hear in this context that we're talking is when I talk to people my age, the biggest complaint is, well, God, I need more energy. I wish I had more energy. Mm-hmm. And the way people turn to get more energy is to eat, because sometimes if they're feeling tired, you know, we have this habit of eating, and, of course, that creates obesity and problems there. And the other way they get more energy is from caffeine. So this is not true energy, but it gives the adrenaline a boost. And, of course, how we see this epidemic of coffee drinking across everywhere, you know, very symptomatic of that. So, but one of the great ways to restore energy in a natural way is to take a 20-minute nap. Now, my nap today actually lasted 40 minutes, and actually it was quite refreshing and rejuvenating for me, and enables me to be talking to you in Los Angeles time at 10 o'clock at night.
Very fresh, you sound.
with relative vitality without needing any kind of caffeine drinks at all. So that I attribute to the nap, which I took about 4 o'clock because I had been actually at work, working since early this morning. And then I was about to go off somewhere with my wife, and I was feeling quite tired. And she said, well, why don't you take a nap? So, you know, I have to be reminded of these things too. And I thought, well, very good idea. Now, the good news about it is I can take a nap. I was tired and I knew I could just close my eyes and sleep. But even if you can't, I mean, in yoga, they talk about one of the more important postures being the savasana, which is the dead posture or the corpse posture, where you actually just lie down at the end of a yoga session. And so just doing that for 20 minutes can be very, very restorative. So, and just focusing on the rising and the falling of the breath. So there are ways to restore our energy if we have the kind of awareness to do it in the moment.
Yeah, I was going to say, actually, one of the things that seems really important in terms of remembering some of these things is it's almost like a conscious awareness to do these things when we get stressed. So for me, the challenge is often is when I am stressed for any reason, it's how do I remember to do these things? I mean, before I started the show and I was just thinking, oh, I'll just do some deep breathing, so it was just like just to get more relaxed. So it's almost like a conscious decision we need to make to be aware of some of these things that work for us.
Yes, I do. When I do personal counseling with people, one of the things that I tell them is that, and I've been in this field for, goodness knows how long now. I forget. We said since I was 14 years old. So years and years of spiritual kind of reading and also, of course, this self-help group area and stuff. And I had one person I was working with, and I said, look, let me just distill for you it down into a simple phrase. You have a bad habit, and we need to turn that into a good habit. And really, that's what it's about. So what you're saying is this constant remembering is really taking what is a bad habit, and then we need to bring our conscious awareness so that it becomes a good habit. And, again, listeners have to keep going to their personal experience. If you reach a state of relaxation, let's say if you can remember back to that vacation time and you come back from the trip and you're just relaxed and you hit the city again and you just realize you're in the cacophony of sound, you see everybody rushing around, it's very jarring on the senses because suddenly you're just aware of the amount of tension and activity and frenetic activity that you had left behind. And then, of course, it doesn't take too long to adapt and once again you're caught up in it. But that initial time that you're away from it, you realize what it is. And as a person begins to relax, and as I've learned to relax, it's been a practice. It's taken me a long time. But as I get to a more relaxed state, then you become aware of how tense people are and how they go about things and how they hold their breath. And it can be quite jarring. So when I'm around people, I'm a bit of a nuisance. I'll just go, hey, can you please just relax a little bit, just take a breath and just slow down.
But actually, that's a beautiful reminder because sometimes that's all we need, is just to be reminded.
Well, we can be reminded.
And how do we remind?
Mm-hmm. Yes, we can be reminded, like you said, but then it's just like the consistent reminder so that we develop it into a habit. So
a
the same
habit,
mechanism
yes.
that got us, yes, that got us into the bad habit in the first place, that mechanism needs to be putting us into the good habit. And what is the mechanism? Repetition.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the things that I sometimes do when I'm trying to change a habit is to actually write down on a card, breathe, relax, put some of these kind of key words and kind of keep it in places where I can see it so that I can keep referring to it so it just is a constant reminder until it becomes a good habit.
That's one way to do it, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, whatever it takes, really, but it does take a doing of it. Otherwise, the old habit kind of just reasserts itself and grows stronger in the process. So that's why I'm very wary of change. It's like if we're going to make a change, let's be committed to it. And so that, and make sure that all of ourselves are lined up behind it. Not that it's just a good idea mentally, but that we have a good feeling about it, that we can move on it physically. A lot of times, what's good mentally, we don't really have a good emotional response to it. So we have to line ourselves up in a kind of a multi-dimensional kind of way and approach it from that level.
I've got a little quote here which is really sort of talking about some of the things we've just been saying, which is it's on the chapter Be On Your Own Side. And it said, it isn't life's events that cause stress, but it is our reaction to those events that activates the symptoms of stress. For the most part, stress is internally generated by our negative attitude towards ourselves and what is going on in life. The choice of our attitude choosing between being tense or relaxed in a situation can be made at any moment. You may thrive on the thrill of stress, but it is likely that there is an addiction to the surge of adrenaline. With practice, you'll find that being completely present with whatever's going on is far more thrilling. And you mentioned that earlier about the adrenaline, because I think that for a lot of people, really kind of pushing through and getting a lot done and spending a lot of time getting things handled out in the world, it makes us feel often like we're getting somewhere. And in actual fact, the truth is often the opposite, that we actually accomplish less, often because we're so busy out there trying to accomplish, rather than sometimes taking that time out, relaxing, doing what you're saying, breathing. And often in that sort of stillness and coming into that quiet place, often we get more inspiration and creativity and ideas on how to do things, and then we can do them more easily. Have you found that that is an experience that you've experienced?
Well, yes. Well, I mean, usually when we get tense and when we are addicted to this adrenaline response, it does get things done. I mean, let's not underestimate it. When you do have that cup of coffee, when you are feeling lethargic, you do get that cup of coffee, you can get quite a lot done. It does definitely focus the attention. So I'm not putting that down as a technique. The point is that long term, it will wear you down because you're exhausting your adrenal, and it will have health complications. And so people really need to be aware of that. And a lot of us who, as I said, have become in their 50s or in their 60s and all of that, suddenly have realized that, we really do need to preserve ourselves a little bit if we're going to continue going on. If a person is in their 20s, they're going to be recovering much quicker. They're not going to care. They're going to be, living it up and spending late nights and doing all those things. But even then, that's going to have an impact on their health, as we're seeing with the current kind of highly caffeinated drinks, which are, five times as strong as coffee and things like that. Mm-hmm. So the point is that if you have a long-term point of view, you're absolutely correct. In the short term, it's a good, coffee is a good solution if you need to have that done.
Well, one of the chapters that you have on ways to restore your energy is about doing nothing. And I think that this is probably, and I've mentioned this to a number of people, and there are people who say, oh, I couldn't possibly just sit and do nothing. And I find that actually quite remarkable, but I think that that is one of the areas that we need that balance in terms of having done a lot, and in terms of some of us who are, as you say, a little bit older and wanting to have greater health. It is good to be able to learn how to do nothing. But it's very difficult for people.
When a person says that they couldn't possibly do nothing, one has to kind of come to the conclusion that they've lost touch with themselves. Mm-hmm. Because, doing nothing isn't staring into space. It's really kind of not doing something out in the world, but being with oneself. And that being with oneself is just an extraordinary experience. And that's where really the subtitle here kicks in, because of the book, or the rest of your life, the subtitle is Finding Repose in the Beloved. And that repose is quite something. So it gets to be more profound. It's not about... There's a lot of techniques in the book for, coping with life and restoring our energy. But ultimately, what we're doing is that we want to be really at rest within ourselves and within this great presence that we call the Beloved, which is loving us unconditionally. And so when we're doing nothing, we can just sit really in a kind of a blissful state attuned to this unconditional loving presence.
Now, for a lot of people, the difficulty in sitting quietly, one is they're not used to it, because, I only drive around and you hear people with, their radios blasting really loud in the car, people, as you say, watching televisions. It's sometimes very, very hard for people to actually have that quiet time. I remember once going on holidays to Portugal, and it was a friend who said she had an apartment. It's a little fishing village. And I had images of this quiet little beach, but when I got there, there were little cafes all the way along. There was music blasting. And if I found a little place on the beach where I couldn't hear the music from a little cafe, somebody on the beach had a radio. So, you know, people often just have a lot of noise going on. And I think that some of the things that show up when there is quietness and there is nothing to distract is a lot of people go into their fears, they go into their worries, they start kind of, you know, putting things over in their head of things that are going on in their lives. And I love this quote that you have from Winston Churchill, which says, "When I look back on all these worries, I remember the story of the old man who said on his deathbed that he'd had a lot of trouble in his life, most of which never happened." So, you know, for you have this chapter on don't worry, be happy, not taking ourselves too seriously. So how do people deal with that kind of those distractions that keep coming up and that kind of mind going round and round?
Well, one way to do it, this is kind of not a popular way, but it's definitely one that works, is that every time that a person should carry around a notebook or a little journal, and every time they have a worry or a fear, they should write it down. And just to do this for about a month or so, and just to see what fears and worries keep repeating themselves, and whether the worries actually come to fruition. And a lot of them are little worries and little concerns and all of that. And it's amazing how many don't, just like that quote. And then it kind of, the writing it down starts to bring the awareness present about exactly whether our fears or worries are justified. And for the most part, they're not. And worrying in itself is not a really good use of energy because it really doesn't get anything done. If one has a concern and moves on it, I think that's just fine. I may be concerned that I didn't lock my door behind me. So I can just go back and check it, and then boom, that's handled. But just to worry about it wouldn't be good use of energy. And my favorite definition of worrying is praying for what you don't want. I kind of like that, and I think it's that kind of really did it for me, because, you know, we just keep focusing, and what we focus on, we start moving towards, and we start creating. So it's important that we don't lose in our fantasies. John Roger, of course, who's been enormously influential, just been tremendous teacher to me over the years, you know, had brought that idea up, and of course is the main author of the book, The Rest of Your Life, and the other books you mentioned. And he mentioned that once. He said, you know, don't lose in your fantasy. And it suddenly just dawned upon me, oh my God, I'm the one making up these fantasies. And why am I starring in my fantasy and I'm the loser? Why don't I just be the winner in my fantasy, since I'm the one making it up anyway? It was a very simple thing, but it was very, very profound. And it's really was quite changing for me.
Yes, I talk quite a bit about John Roger as my spiritual teacher and the value that I've received over the years. And there's a lovely little quote that I'd like to do again from about no need to defend, because I think, you know, many of us were brought up to be quite competitive. And today, I was actually thinking today, I was thinking, it's not as bad today, but in actual fact, I think it's a lot worse. I mean, you know, you can read about young children who are in psychoanalysis because their parents want them to perform well. It's a lot of pressure on people to perform, so therefore it often engenders a lot of competitiveness. And John Rogers says, when it comes right down to it, there's no such thing as winning or losing. There is only experience. If I act out of integrity and loving, it doesn't matter who is right. I think that in a lot of relationships, that kind of being right, wrong sort of tends to, and control seems to tend to be something that rears its head a lot. Can you talk a little bit more about how to detach from your limitations?
Well, again, I think if you're talking about limitations, it's the limitations that we place on ourselves. And some of those are realistic. I mean, I can't jump 10 foot up into the air. So, but other of them are very unrealistic when we say that'll never happen or I can't do that, and we start placing boundaries around us that don't exist. Whereas we can live a more kind of unconditional life and just say, well, we'll see what happens, or I'll give it a shot, or I'll do my best. I learn Tai Chi Chuan, which is a internal martial art and a way of moving, and that's based on relaxation and breath. And my Tai Chi teacher one day said to me, he said, do not speak words of weakness, even in your dreams. And it kind of had an impact on me, because he was really saying that, you know, what you believe in your heart is what you will become. And he really, you know, took me up short on that. And that had an impact on me as well, because I didn't realize. I think I was whining a little bit or saying, look, I'll never be good at this, I think is what I actually said. And he was just all over me for it. So, and I've stopped doing that. I mean, what's the point of saying I'll never be good at this? It's like, well, just give it the best shot you can and see what happens. And it's more of just a very simple thing. I mean, it's just more of an openness rather than declaring something against ourselves. And that's what I find difficult these days when I see, because it kind of, I've become sensitive to it. It's just like, why hurt yourself? Why place a negative thought against yourself? I mean, there's absolutely no need to do that, and no point about doing it.
That is absolutely accurate. I love that. Do not speak words of weakness, even in your dreams. That's pretty profound. I really like that. Paul, you've got a lot of beautiful techniques in this book, and just a lot. And the thing that I love about it is a lot of them are really simple and easy to implement. And I think that's really important, so that we can understand, so that we can do things that really have, you know, profound results. Because, you know, obviously if we keep doing things, even small things, on a consistent basis, it's obviously very hugely impactful for us. So what I would love to ask you to do is, would you be willing to do a little meditation for everybody? Maybe just think
about it. Well, sure. One thing I could do, since all the passages are pretty meditative, I could just read and see what comes forward for people.
Absolutely. That would be lovely.
So I've just opened the book here at a random place, and it's called Precipitating Goodness in Your Life. When you live life knowing that you are worthy of God's presence in your life, you bring good and abundant things into your life. You are open to God's love, so love comes to you. You are aware of the joy in your life, so you manifest more joy. So let's just take a moment now just to realize inside of us that we are worthy of God's presence in our life. And let's be open to God's love. We can call God the Beloved. And as we just attune to the Beloved, let's just look at that word, be loved. And allow yourself to be loved. And one way that you can know that you're being loved is perhaps you feel your shoulders just drop an inch or two. Perhaps you've been holding them a little too high. And just being aware of God's love, the Beloved, being aware of that presence, you may find yourself flowing into your breath. Just a gentle rising and falling. Perhaps the breath goes lower in your body and you find yourself getting more relaxed. Manifestation is successful only if it results in a change of consciousness. That's a little different from how most people see it. Manifestation has usually been defined as the ability to make something appear physically. But if you only take into account the materialization of a physical form, you have missed the essence of creation. When manifestation results in a change of consciousness, you no longer need to see the form in the outer world, but you move to the very essence of its fulfillment inside of you, and then you truly have it. Truly having something does not mean you possess it as a form, but that it is present for you in its essence. You don't possess your breath, nor do you possess the air around you as a form. Yes, you do need it, yet when you take a breath in, there is no longer a need because it is present within you. So, we can receive a breath. It's interesting that we use the word take a breath. So right now, before we receive a breath, there's a prior thing we must do, and that is let go. And we let go through exhaling. So as we let go and allow the breath to leave, we also create space for the breath to enter. And so we receive the breath into us, we let it fill us, and then we let it go again. This breath is a wonderful metaphor for life. In order to receive, we must let go. And in order to receive again, we must let go even more. And the letting go is the letting go of what we no longer need. And in our breath, it's the toxins. It's the stale air. And we just let it go without any force. And perhaps we find that pause at the end of the exhalation, which is our little moment of rest that we can have with each breath. And that pause allows us to rest before we receive the next breath into us. To precipitate goodness or godness in your life, move always to the essence. Successful manifestation is moving the goodness from the soul through the intuition and into the consciousness. The essence of the soul is abundance. Spirit is naturally abundant because it is the substance from which all things are created. There is nothing that is not spirit. To be abundant from the soul level does not mean having access to many things. It means having access to the essence of all things and being in communion with the one essence. When you are in that divine communion, you never feel lack. So if you want to experience true abundance, practice divine communion. So be with yourself. Be with the essence of who you are. Be in the presence of the beloved. Be in that presence that loves you unconditionally, which means that whatever you have done does not matter at this moment. You are loved. So receive that loving into you. Let it fill you. Let it permeate every part of your being on every level, so that all separation dissolves and falls away, and you find yourself present in the awareness that you are love, and that you're in the presence of the beloved. And in that sacred presence, if there's a prayer you have, or there's something you wish to place into the light, for the highest good, you can just do that now in the next few seconds. For you are blessed. You are loved. You are divine. Beirush Beishan. Which means the blessings already are. And that's how we like to end our meditations.
Lovely, Paul. Thank you for that. I just found myself, even, you know, towards the beginning of that, I just found myself actually just taking deeper breaths in. Just, it was just lovely. Thank you very much. So I'd like to, because we did, last couple of weeks ago, we had John Morton on, and we did mention tithing and seeding, and I mentioned that you were actually going to be on the show today, so I would like to take a little time to talk a little bit about the tithing and seeding to people. And because you are the person in MSIA that we know of, you've been nicknamed Lord Tithington. You've become titled. How lovely. It's very British, isn't it? Lord Tithington. So could you tell us, Paul, a little bit about what tithing is?
Well, the Lord Tithington thing was interesting because it was just a little joke that I brought up. Mm-hmm. But it was something that that stuck. People seem to get a kick out of it, and they love referring to me as Lord Tithington. And since it's been going on for 25 years ago, I thought it was getting a bit old, so I kind of just dropped the title. But people loved calling it to me. I mean, it still gives people a smile and everything. So I've become Lord Tithington. And tithing is the act of giving 10% to the source of one's spiritual teachings, or to God, essentially. And it's just saying thank you. Tithing is saying thank you for what you've given me. This didn't come, it may have come from my own efforts, but really it's a recognition that all things come from God. And as such, we make this gesture of tithing as a remembrance and as a gratefulness and as a thankfulness that we have received. And then when we do that, what happens is that just like the breath, where we need to exhale to receive, by just giving in this way, in a joyful, unconditional way, we create space to actually receive more. And although we don't necessarily do it for that reason, we do it to give thanks, it actually does have that effect. So people who tithe consistently find that they just receive so much more. It doesn't necessarily mean more money, but it can oftentimes receive more blessings, more wonderful things in their lives, and they become more grateful, radiant people as a result.
One of the things that, because obviously it's around money and there seems to be quite a lot of challenges around money, some people get into tremendous resistance. And I would just like to quote from the book, God is Your Partner. And John Rogers says, the basic principle of abundance is that you tithe on the first fruits of the harvest. If you're not, then you're thwarting yourself of receiving the abundance that comes from tithing. Some people say, I don't have enough money to meet my bills, let alone tithe. That may be very true. And it may be like that all their life, because they do not have God as their partner. They have themselves as a selfish partner. So in other words, really, it's affirming what they don't want. They're affirming they don't have enough money to pay the bills, that they don't have enough money to do what they need to do. So tithing is also another way, really, in a way that gives it comes from a greater level of faith and trust in the Lord, that by tithing I am taken care of. Can you say anything more about that?
Well, no, I think that was very profound. And, you know, I put the book God is Your Partner together, and then we just recently did a revised version. By the way, if any of your listeners would like a book, God is Your Partner, I'd be quite happy to send it to them free of charge. If they just send me an email at my initials, pk@msia.org, I'm more than happy to do that. So that's pk, two letters, at msia.org. And quite happy to send them the book. It's a magnificent book and totally inspirational. But I think you covered it beautifully. One of the things I've been doing these days is, since July, I've been doing a daily blog on the spiritual principles of abundance and prosperity. And you mentioned seeding, which is another spiritual principle. And I talk about those on a daily basis. And today's entry, actually, I just refer to other blogs because obviously we're in the midst in the United States of an enormous financial crisis. I mean, just enormous. I mean, the likes of which really haven't been seen before. And I just didn't want to ignore that in the midst of all of that. So, so although the financial game in the world seems to have undergone a radical change in the last few months, the spiritual principles don't change, and they're things that we can constantly do. And it's really quite sound money management. So if you were interested in my daily blog, this isn't an advertisement, but I think it's germane to what we're talking about, You can just go to a website called www.godisyourpartner.org, and you'll find blog there along with information on tithing and seeding, and all of these are wonderful spiritual principles that we can apply in a practical way and allow us to live a life of abundance and prosperity.
So could you tell us a little bit more about the seeding process?
The seeding process is very much like one would do in an agricultural context. We seed. If we want a harvest, if we want to have tomatoes, we plant tomato seeds. And those seeds look nothing like the tomatoes that they're going to become. So there needs to be a faith in it, that indeed when someone places that seed in your hand and says it's going to be a tomato tree or whatever, tomato plant, then you need to say, really? Or you need to go, yes, we know that's to be true. So basically when we place that seed in the ground, we need to put it in essentially fertile soil, a place where it can grow. We need to have it watered. And we also need to have the faith that it's going to grow. We don't dig up the seed every day just to see if it's growing or not. We just leave it and we wait. And so the seeding that we do is a very similar process whereby we want something in our life, the harvest, and we give a seed, a small amount of money that we seed into, again, the source of our spiritual teachings, into God, which would be whatever that is for each person. It could be your local church, your synagogue, or mosque, or whatever it is, or your spiritual source. You give the money to them unconditionally, you let it go, and you're in a sense placing your seed, your wish, into God's hands. And then part of the seeding process is to make the claim. So when you place that tomato seed, in our earlier example, in a sense you make the claim that you're going to have tomatoes. You're not saying, well, I hope that I'm going to have tomatoes. You're planting it for the purpose. So you make the claim and you just say it is done and you have what you want. So it does involve tremendous faith, no doubts, and just absolute certainty that this is going to take place. And of course, you always ask for the highest good. And if it doesn't take place in exactly the way you want it, you can be sure that there's a divine intervention bringing you what is for your highest good, not necessarily what you want, if that was going to get you into trouble.
Yes, I remember talking to a friend of mine who was going through some challenges, and I said, why don't you seed? And she said, I've done that before, and it didn't work. And I think that often there is that kind of expectation that it's very specific that we seed for something, and we don't recognize always that the gift that comes back could be different than what we think it is, but it's really what we need.
Completely. Beautifully said. Very, very well said indeed. Yes, a seed is never wasted. It's always used for something. And sometimes you just need to look around. I remember I was seeding for a specific thing. And I was doing everything right, you know, really looking for it. And I thought, God, for sure this is going to come in, and what's going on? And then I realized that the seed had been absolutely answered, but it had been answered in a different way, in a different form, but much easier than the way I was contemplating. The way it came in was no work on my part whatsoever, and the word I had seeded for would have involved lots of work on my part. And I just had to look in a different direction, and it was more rewarding than what I'd asked for.
Well, I have a wonderful seeding story for you, Paul, and I know you love to hear tithing and seeding stories, but one of the things over the years that I have often seeded for is that when I'm going on overseas trips and I can't always get the flight that I want, and I've seeded and I've always gotten to get on the plane that I wanted. Anyway, this time a couple of years ago, I was in Sydney. I was going on a trip to England, and I wanted to go through Perth because I have like this adopted Australian mother who lives there, and it was a big birthday for her, and I wanted to show up and surprise her. Well, the travel agent tried everything they could to get me a direct flight through, but the best that he could do for me was an overnight trip in Hong Kong, and I'm thinking, I don't want to do an overnight trip. You know, us girls, often travel with a lot of luggage. I still haven't quite worked that one out. And the thought of getting off a plane for one night, getting all my luggage. Anyway, so I thought, well, And I stopped and I thought, I know somebody in Hong Kong. And in fact, she's, you know, involved in MSIA. And I thought, I'll give her a call. So I gave her a call. She was delighted to hear from me, put me up for the night, said, would love to catch up with you. And she said to me, look, just pack an overnight bag because at Hong Kong airport, we can actually check your luggage through so you don't actually have to, you know, schlep your luggage. So I get to Perth, I check in, and I said, look, can I check my luggage through to England? And they said, oh, yes, if you're only doing an overnight stay, we'll check it all the way through for you. So I ended up with one small bag, you know, just overnighter, had a lovely time in Hong Kong, got back to the airport next day, got upgraded to business class, which was very nice, got to London, no luggage. So the next thing that happens, I report it. I'm staying with a friend overnight and then moving, going by train to Northampton the next day. My luggage arrived in Northampton ahead of me, and it meant I didn't have to worry about taking it on the train. So the beautiful thing was, it was easy. My whole trip actually was easy, but it wasn't what I originally wanted, but it turned out to be a lovely, grace-filled trip. So sometimes we get things that are just beautiful, but we don't realize it, because sometimes it's like, I'm trying to get what I think I need or what I want and controlling it. So it was a lovely opportunity for me just to really let go.
So well, thank you for that. Yeah, you had mentioned that, you know, I love to hear seating stories. And the reason I love to see to hear them is because it's just always uplifting, because it's the way that spirit or God, the beloved, is moving in people's lives. And you just gave a beautiful example of that. Of the way, you know, just the letting go process allow for something much greater to be come forward. So thanks for sharing that.
Yes. Well, I guess the bottom line really about tithing and seeding is that we're basically working with God as our partner, that we're co-creators with God. And to me, it's like, you know, with God on my side, hey, you know, those odds are definitely improved on when I try to do things by myself. And it is, for me, a process of just letting go. And somebody just suggested to me very recently, had I ever thought of seeding every day? Because I love seeding. I seed for all sorts of things, for myself, for other people. And I hadn't ever actually done a seeding every day. So I've just started doing that, and I really love it. I love that little process. You know, I think a lot of people think that because you're seeding to get something that it has to be a huge amount of money. But sometimes it can be just a small amount of money. So if you actually don't have a lot, it's just a small amount. To me, it's the intention in the heart while we're doing it that seems to be the most important thing.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, sometimes it's just nice just to do a small amount. So sometimes we should look for like a tenfold return at the very minimum. It depends on each person. It really relates to differently, because I mentioned earlier on placing that seed in the soil. Well, many of us have different kinds of soil. Some of us have a very lack consciousness. Some of us have are very good with money, you know, and all of those kind of things. And our particular, what we would call our karma, is different. But one should look for a minimum of a tenfold return. So as an experiment, you know, your listeners could seed $1 to receive $10. And it's a very interesting process. And then see how that works and see if the $10 comes in. But, of course, it's done with the thing of like, yes, you see the dollar, and then you look for the $10. It's coming in. You've claimed it. And a big part of it as well is also seeing yourself in the picture, making sure that you're actually seeing that you're receiving it. It's not just that there's a $10 out there, but it's actually coming into your hand. And sometimes it can help to see what you're going to do with that $10. So it's a very active process involved, and again, always for the highest good.
And having said that, there has been a couple of occasions where I've sort of seeded for some things and I went inside and kind of checked in how much. And I remember one time it was like it cleaned out my bank account, and I just thought, you know what, if I'm trusting in God, I'm trusting in God. And, you know, I just really value that process. So I'm really grateful that, you know, you've kind of been the person really who keeps talking about this, because it's a constant reminder of just how much gratitude I have for spirit and for just the wonderful tools that we have in order to live our lives in a greater way. So sadly, Paul, it looks like we've come to the end of our time today. It seems to have gone very, very quickly indeed.
I have so much more to say.
There is a lot more to say, which means we'll have to have you back again.
Oh, that's very nice of you. Thank you.
I would love to have you back again. And I really want to finish with a quote from The Rest of Your Life, which is called Walking Grace. If you think that being the beloved is going to give you everything you want in this world, you have missed the point. The beloved is a desireless state. You will get everything you want when you are in complete acceptance, cooperation, understanding, and empathy for whatever is present. But the wants that are being fulfilled are not the wants of the emotions, but the wants of the heart. And as soon as a but appears in your mind, you have stepped out of the energy field of the beloved and have thrust yourself into the world again. Don't be concerned, for the beloved waits for your return. You can return to the beloved on your breath, on your gratitude, on your loving, and on your unconditional giving. There are many ways into the beloved when you are prepared to let go and let God. Your reward will be the enthusiasm you have for your life, regardless of your circumstances. You will walk in grace, and the grace of God did not say for one moment that you wouldn't have any pain or that you wouldn't meet any adversity. Its only promise is that you are going to live in the Spirit while you walk through this world. Thank you, Paul. It's been lovely talking to you. And God bless you, and God bless everyone. Beirush Beishan.
Thank you very much for having me. I've had a wonderful time.
Thank you.